Well, I'd like to take the opportunity to tell you about something that's completely new and very fresh. It's a laboratory model for rainfall. It's work that's been done in collaboration with an experimental group. Jürgen Vollmer has been pushing this type of experiment for years. And Tobias Lapp has recently made some very, who's a diploma student, no, a PhD student, has recently made some very extensive experimental investigations. And my own contribution was to give pointers to a theoretical framework enabling the results to be explained. So I'd like to start off just by giving some background on clouds and rainfall and say a little bit about what this may or may not have to do with turbulence. Then I'll say something about the Göttingen experiment, which is the main topic, which is a kind of model for rainfall in a test tube. I'll talk about its analysis, which uses the Lifshitz-Slezov theory for Ostwald ripening, which I think seems to be a new ingredient in discussions of rain-related phenomena. And finally, I'll conclude by asking if there are any general lessons applicable to real clouds, and I'll suggest that indeed there are some. So, should start off with the very basics. What is a rain cycle? Rain is made in a cyclic process. You start off by evaporating water into a mass of air. Then something causes the air to cool. That would make the water supersaturated, but normally there are sufficient nucleation centers present that water vapor will come into a liquid or at higher altitudes an ice phase, relieving the supersaturation. And this creates clouds, which are just masses of droplets of very fine droplets of water vapor. Typical size of the water droplets in the cloud is microscopic. It's about 10 microns radius is a typical value. Now, to get from a cloud to rainfall, what has to happen is that the water droplets have to get bigger. And it's normally assumed that this proceeds by droplets colliding with each other. They get larger and larger. Eventually, they start to be heavy enough that they fall at an appreciable rate under gravity. When they start to fall at an appreciable rate, the larger droplets can catch up the smaller ones, coalesce with them, and then they fall at an even faster rate, so that there can be a runaway growth of the size of the droplets until they reach a macroscopic size, the size of raindrops, typically about a millimeter. And as the rain falls through the atmosphere, it sweeps away all the excess moisture. You end up with drier air, and you can start the process all over again. So that's the rain cycle. You might be asking why talk about this as meeting on turbulence. Well, there is a good motivation. I should say something about the different types of cloud that exist. There are really two major cloud types, stratus and cumulus cloud, illustrated by these two pictures. Stratus clouds are layers of cloud that form in an atmosphere which is stable against convection. So the rate of decrease of temperature as you increase in height is less than the adiabatic lapse rate. There's no possibility of convection occurring. And if there's no convection, there will be no turbulence in the atmosphere. And this type of cloud can produce rain. It's associated with rain that's of rather slow onset and which comes from warm fronts when a mass of warmer air is sliding above some colder air. The other type of cloud is cumulus cloud, pictured here. And cumulus or clumpy cloud results when you have cold air on top, sliding on top from a cold front. That makes a situation which is unstable to convection. And you have large convective circulations in the atmosphere. As warmer and moister air rises, water precipitates out, forms little droplets, and forms these beautiful fluffy clouds that you see here. And this type of cloud is associated with turbulence and with much more rapid onset of rain in the form of showers or thunderstorms. So there's a suggestion that turbulence is relevant in distinguishing different types of rainfall.
I have a question with respect to stratus clouds. I mean, inside these clouds you have indeed convection often, because you see it at the patterns of those clouds, even in this picture.
Yep.
There is sort of hole-like structures which indicate some convection.
In that type of picture, there does appear to be certainly a length scale with some unevenness. Now, this can happen for very many different reasons. And a very typical thing is that there is some high ground upwind of the cloud that you are seeing, and that creates essentially gravity waves, which cause waves to appear in the structure of the cloud. Now, it's certainly the case that on about 50% of the days, the atmosphere is definitely convectively stable. And these other structures that you see will have some one of many other types of origin other than being at the bottom of a convective cell. So I think there are many possible supplementary reasons for seeing a spatial structure at the bottom of a stratus cloud. This isn't stratus cloud is almost by definition found in a convectively stable atmosphere. When people try and explain rainfall, they have to discuss how droplets grow from well over a range of three decades in size, from being microscopic water droplets to macroscopic raindrops. And this involves quite a lot of possible kinetic processes. The initial stage is always some sort of condensation of supersaturated vapor onto a nucleation sensor. But then for the droplets to grow, people consider a variety of different processes involving collision and coalescence. And for droplets to coalesce, there needs to be a relative velocity, and this could be due to Brownian motion of little water droplets, gravitational settling. Both of these are always present. And then if the atmosphere is unstable, there can be turbulence in the cloud. And turbulence can give rise to shearing motions, which would enable water droplets to come into contact, as suggested by Safman and Turner and other people. Now, in the literature of cloud physics, it's frequently argued that there's a major problem, which is called a condensation collision bottleneck. It's claimed that there's a problem explaining how water droplets can grow from a range of about 15 microns in radius, which is easily achieved just by condensation, up to a stage of 50 microns when the gravitational settling becomes significant. Doubtless, particles can collide by Brownian diffusion, but that's a very slow process. And it's been argued that, in fact, turbulence in the cloud is, in fact, necessary to bridge this growth bottleneck between 15 and 50 microns. But this is certainly a situation where there's very complex physics involved. I'll just mention some of the physical parameters and discuss whether turbulence might be significant. So physical parameters for a cloud are discussed, for example, in this reference. Typical size of droplets produced by condensation, I've said, is radius about 10 micron. Typical density, 10 to the 8 per cubic meter. Now, when turbulence is present, the intensity of the turbulence is rather uncertain. If you make very generous estimates using the velocities of the largest updrafts that you tend to see in clouds, you end up with crude estimates for the rate of dissipation about equal to this value in SI units. Combine this with the Kolmogorov kinematic viscosity of air, and you get estimates for the Kolmogorov length and the Kolmogorov time scale. Kolmogorov time scale about 100 for the second. And also for droplets of this size, the damping rate for bringing the water droplet, for damping its relative velocity relative to the air, that's about 500 per second.
This is probably the strongest turbulence imaginable, kind of.
It is, yes. It's an extreme case. And even with this rather extreme value of turbulence, you can get up to Stokes numbers of about 0.2. So this, and I should remind people of that state, that in order to see significant effects of turbulence, you really need values of the Stokes number which are of order 1.
Can you remind the definition of Stokes number?
Stokes number is a measure of the extent to which the motion of the water molecule, water droplets, relative to the air is underdamped. So there's a time scale associated with turbulent motion, tau, the Kolmogorov scale. There's a damping rate. The equation of motion for a droplet is gamma into U minus R double dot is gamma into fluid velocity minus R dot. This is a damping rate proportional to the viscosity of the air. And from these numbers, you can obtain a dimensionless number, the Stokes number, that measures the extent to which the motion of water droplets is underdamped. If the Stokes number is of order unity or higher, you can get some very important results which show that water droplets can cluster together. There are also causticks formed in the phase space of the water droplets, which, as Risha has shown, and Bernard Mehlig and myself, can lead to enhanced clustering rates due to increased collision velocities. But this appears to be a rather marginal mechanism because, as Grisha points out, this is a rather extreme value for the turbulence. So although Stokes numbers of order unity would help, they seem only to be possible under extreme conditions in clouds. So appealing to turbulence may not be such a good idea.
All those numbers fluctuate in turbulence, right?
Yeah.
In particular, Stokes number. So whenever typical Stokes number is 0.2, in fluctuations you can get basically,
I'm really saying that a typical Stokes number or an extreme Stokes number would be 0.2. Typical values would be much smaller. Of course, an uncertain aspect of all of this is that turbulence is intermittent, and there can undoubtedly be regions where there would be local fluctuations, which would give much larger Stokes numbers. However, those are of relatively little weight in terms of their probability. And it's a rather delicate issue to figure out whether they are significant or not. But I'm really going to veer away from looking at issues of the importance of turbulence, because I'm going to suggest other mechanisms which indicate that it might, that this question might be a bit of a dead end. Yeah, so I was saying that the physics is indeed rather complicated. Turbulence perhaps is a bit marginal. And it would be desirable, really, to have some laboratory models to look at. People have tried doing experiments on water vapor in large tanks. These can show interesting convective phenomena, but they're really too small to produce genuine rainfall. I have heard reports that there are some nuclear reactors cooled by liquid sodium that have a sort of rain cycle occurring within them. But not surprisingly, it's rather hard to get real information about what's going on there. What I'm going to pursue is an alternative approach, which is very much laboratory scale and purely liquid based. It's something that's been pursued by Jürgen Vollmer over about the past decade. And he's done a series of experiments which use two partially miscible liquids in what's basically a test tube, just a small cell. And the temperature is varied in such a way that you decrease the miscibility of the two liquids. And as you do this, they become less intersoluble, and some material comes out of solution, and it forms little droplets. These droplets grow in size as they coalesce, and they move towards the interface as rain. So there's an upper and a lower layer. Little droplets rain downwards from the upper layer, and they rain upwards from the lower layer. And what's actually seen is that these rain events can be, they can just be seen directly as an increase in turbidity or cloudiness of the liquid mixture. They're roughly periodic in time, and they have a period which increases as the rate of cooling decreases. So the latest Göttingen experiment is shown schematically here. It uses a mixture of water and isobutoxyethanol. These actually separate above a temperature of 25 Celsius.
What is the specific gravity of this ethanol?
I believe it's the lighter phase, but I have to check that, and I don't know precisely what its density is. Of course, as you approach miscibility, the densities of the two phases approach each other. So you get a very wide range of differences in density and buoyancy.
It's 0.8 to begin.
I'll take
At 25 degrees.
Above this temperature, at 25. Yeah.
So this is lighter phase.
Well, almost all organics are in the range 0.7 to 0.8, yeah.
This is a lower consolute point?
Sorry?
It is a lower consolute point,
right? It is, yes, which is unusual but not unprecedented.
Of course, yes.
Yeah. So the experiment is that there is a tank of water, a little cell containing the materials. It says surfactant here just because this material is well investigated, because it does behave as a surfactant. But from the point of view of this experiment, you should just think of it as being any other liquid. There's a light source and a camera. The camera goes to a computer with some image processing software that can determine the distribution of sizes of the droplets. And temperature control is by a computer-controlled thermostat, which is programmed to control the temperature in a particular way, as I'll describe briefly. These are some representative plots of the results. So what you have here is a density plot on the logarithmic scale, indicating that...
I have to understand. Where is this code?
Where is it?
Well, you know, there's double diffusive convection, right? So you have to worry a little bit about ray-driven convection, which you know, you can easily get in these systems of water and alcohol, and you get oscillations, and you get all wonderful things. And so what is this ray effect in this? What's the separation ratio? Is it negative or positive?
Well, the temperature is thermostatically controlled by this. I didn't actually see a stir in the bath, but I presume there is some circulation there. The rate of change of temperature is very slow. It's changed over a time scale of hours.
Okay.
So if you're thinking of sort of effects of something coming out of solution and there's a latent heat involved which sets up a convection roll, no, nothing like that is happening. This is thermostatics in the water, which is controlled very accurately.
But I see the whole thing is isothermal.
It's isothermal, yeah. Anyway, the device, as I said, is in fact heated rather than cooled over a period of several hours. This is a plot of the density of the droplets as a function of particle size, shown on a logarithmic scale. So because this is a logarithmic scale, you can see that there are some very big differences between the particle density, which are more or less periodic in time, although the period does decrease as you get further into the experiment. Also, the oscillations do, for some reason, seem to be becoming less distinct.
This is average over the whole tank, or this is at a particular location?
This is all done with a tiny cell at a particular location. So the cell is perhaps, think of the size of a test tube, that's all. It has rectangular walls, but it's test tube sized. The rate of cooling is chosen so that a particular parameter psi is kept constant. And this is the fractional rate of change of the volume of the droplets produced per unit time. And you can relate this to properties of the phase diagram. It's inversely proportional to the miscibility gap of the two liquids. But the experiments are all done with the temperature profile chosen to keep psi constant. It's not essential, but for some reason they have been making a dimensionless variable out of the temperature. And the actual results are summarized here. T, for which I've used delta T in my own text to distinguish with temperature, T is the period of the oscillation. And xi, the dimensionless, or the heating rate. And there's a good data collapse for the experiment if you assume that the period is proportional to xi to the minus 3/7.
Still huge scatter in this logarithmic scale.
It's not such a huge scatter. I should say that the crosses here are the upper cell. The other symbols are the lower cell, with different choices of the depth of the lower layer. So this set of data above and the lower set are actually, two separate experiments. So within any one experiment, as you'd expect from looking at the raw data, you do indeed see quite a lot of scatter, approaching a factor of two. The systematics of this plot make it clear that it's unlikely that you will find another scaling relation which will do better. There's Apart from an effect that I'll describe later on, there's nothing systematic about points of one color, form, or whatever, deviating further from the trend line than anything else. So the indications are that this is indeed the correct scaling collapse.
Is the proximity to the critical point of any relevance, or it's just an accident?
As you approach the critical point, there's quite a few things happen of significance. Both the interfacial tension between the liquids and also the difference in density are very important for the theoretical description. And both of those go through a singularity. Both of them vanish at the critical point. So the fact that the dimensionless temperature has been taken very low in this plot is a good test of the correct relation, the correct scaling of those quantities in the theory. Anyway, so that was the experiment.
So basically, the periodicity is just through the time it takes for a new droplet to grow after it's already rained out in one location.
So I'll come to what the model is next. So there is a periodicity here. And I'm going to argue that the effect is rather similar to drizzle from stratus clouds. After droplets have rained out, I'll claim that there's negligible supersaturation. You heat further, and that causes material to come out of solution, nucleating onto dust particles, which we assume are always present in sufficient numbers. Then the crucial new ingredient here is I'm going to claim that the droplets are actually growing by a process called Ostwald-Weichmann. Then the story is the same as for the standard description of rainfall. When the droplets are large enough, they drift towards the interface at a significant rate. As they grow, they catch up smaller droplets, they coalesce, they get bigger, density contrast gets greater. And the model will show that there is a finite time singularity. The droplets get very big, they sweep clear the solution, leaving it with no excess material, and then the rain cycle can start over again.
The nucleation sites are always present in the same concentration?
Well, we don't know, but we have to assume that they are. There's no evidence that they're not. Of course, very limited evidence about what these sites might be, but of course, it's very hard to make. It's notoriously hard to make anything pure enough that homogeneous nucleation is really going to be an issue. So I think most people would be with us in assuming that there's always sufficient nucleation sites. New ingredient is something called Ostwald-Weichmann. It's not such a new idea. It's been around since the end of the 19th century. In its first manifestation, it was discovered in the annealing properties of metal alloys. It was found that the grains of annealed alloys grew with time in a particular way. But the easiest example to explain is just the one we're looking at, water droplets in air. So the idea is that when you have a suspension of water droplets, microscopic water droplets in air, they're very unlikely all to have the same size. And because they have different sizes, the Laplace pressure inside a droplet, which is an excess pressure equal to twice the surface tension divided by droplet's radius, will be different for different droplets. And greater the Laplace pressure, the greater the degree of supersaturation of vapor would be necessary to stabilize a droplet against evaporation. So for any degree of supersaturation, only one droplet size can be stable. Droplets less than that size will evaporate, those greater will grow. And what happens is the Laplace pressure in effect forces water molecules away from the small, out of the smaller droplets, and they have to go somewhere, they condense onto the larger droplets. So the end result is that the large fellows grow, the smaller ones shrink, and very rapidly disappear. And from the point of view of understanding rain-like phenomena, this is rather an attractive mechanism, because the diffusion of the water molecules from one drop to another is a much faster process than Brownian diffusion of a droplet, so that it can collide with a larger droplet. So I'd argue that it's physically obvious that this Ostwald ripening mechanism will always win over collisions due to Brownian motion. Now, there is a theoretical description of this process, which dates from the late 50s and early 60s. I think Lifshitz and Slezov were both first.
Slezov or Spiozov?
Actually, I'm confused about that. There's there's two similar names up here, and I'm not sure if it's a transliteration issue.
No, it's the same guy.
I thought it was, yeah.
In Lando Lifshitz, it's Spiozov.
It is there in many other sources. It's Slezov. He spells himself Slezov now. I think he's still active in publishing. As far as I can tell, it is the same fella. I think these two were a bit earlier and a bit better, but very shortly after, there was an essentially independent work by Gardner in the West. And the full Lifshitz level theory I don't really need, but I'll just summarize some important points. So the very surface of a droplet is in contact with water vapor at a concentration which depends upon the radius of the droplet and is slightly higher than the equilibrium concentration, the equilibrium saturation vapor pressure or vapor concentration. And this number here is called the capillary length. It depends upon the surface tension, also on the equilibrium volume fraction of water vapor. It's argued by Lifshitz Slezov that the concentration in the vicinity of a droplet obeys Laplace's equation. It therefore has a 1 over R dependence. It reaches an asymptote, which is the equilibrium concentration plus some supersaturation at large radius. And you then argue that because this concentration has a gradient with respect to radius, that implies a diffusion of water molecules onto the surface of the droplet. This diffusion causes the droplet to change in size. And by manipulating this expression, you find an expression for the rate of change of the radius, such that droplets that are less than a size A naught are going to shrink, those greater than A naught are going to grow, and A naught is the capillary length divided by the supersaturation. Now, Lifshitz Slezov go on and do a lot more with the model. They show that there are solutions that are...
It's signed, Michael. It's small. You want small a to be dt negative, right?
Small a, you want for small a, you want dt negative. I think you're right. I think I missed the sign. My mistake. Yeah. I was saying that Lifshitz and Slezov produced a very elaborate theory, which I don't need, which shows that the distribution of particle sizes approaches a certain scaling form. What I'm going to do is to just simplify this crudely by saying that we don't really care about the smallest droplets, which are going to evaporate anyway. It's the largest droplets here which are the important actors. For those, the evaporation term is negligible, and I can approximate the equation that I gave as just being that one. And then we have to supplement this with another term.
Why it's 1 over a squared, not over 1 over a times a naught? You can go to the previous page, it seems that it's supposed to be... I mean, look, when a very large...
Yeah, right, actually, I made a mistake, yeah.
So it's 1 over a.
It's 1 over a, but a and a naught will in step with each other.
Yeah, well, that's...
Yeah. But you're right, I did make a slip on this one. The largest droplets which will have an equation growth, which should strictly be d sigma over a naught times a. But for these droplets, as they get sufficiently large, what's going to happen is that their motion will become significant. They will start to sink at a rate which is obtained, a rate u, which is obtained by balancing their buoyancy difference against the Stokes drag formula. If you do that, you find the sink rate is some formula, is some number kappa times a squared. This leads to a term in the rate of growth of a droplet, which is proportional to the sink rate, and therefore proportional to a squared, also proportional to the amount of excess material in the solution, which is ready to be absorbed in the form of smaller droplets waiting to be captured and absorbed. So we argue that you can model the growth of the larger droplets by a very crude simplified model of this form. The collision efficiency epsilon, I'll just take to be unity. The initial growth before this term kicks in is just Ostfeld ripening, which has a solution given by Lifshitz and Slezov of this form. And if I put these things together, what I claim is that there are two epochs in the growth of a droplet. An initial growth for a time t1 by Ostwald ripening, then a runaway growth to a singularity taking a time t2. The overall period is the sum of these. I can determine t1 by asking when these two terms are comparable to each other. That gives one relation relating the size of that time a1 and t1. The initial growth was given by the Ostfeld ripening law. I put these things together and I get a scaling for T1. If I look at the finite time singularity arising from the second term in the equation and do the algebra, I'll find that T1 and T2 are comparable. So the result of this is that I construct an expression for delta t of this form. It has various terms appearing in the prefactor of Zeitzon minus 3 over 7. There's some multiplicative dimensionless constant which is unknown and which we'd have to obtain from simulations. There is enough data available on the viscosity, diffusion coefficients of this system, etc., that the coefficient kappa and also the capillary length can be determined from published data.
Yeah, I don't understand why this mechanism should lead to a periodicity. It could also occur in a continuous fashion.
It's leading to a periodicity because once the droplets become very large, fall very quickly, they're going to sweep away all of the smaller droplets. We assume all, yeah.
It's a finite system, that's why.
Yeah. And that will in effect give a clean slate for you to start again. And indeed the experiments do in fact show a pretty periodic behaviour, at least over most of the regime that's investigated. The data plotted here do seem to fit this scaling relation. There are two lines plotted. The upper one is for the theoretical prediction with alpha equals 1 for the upper layer in the solution. The bottom one is the theoretical prediction, again with alpha equals 1, for the lower layer. Now, for some reason, there's a ratio of roughly a factor of 2, more or less consistently, between the prediction in the upper layer and the actual values, in the lower layer and the actual values, whereas in the upper layer, the prediction, so-called, and the actual experimental data are more or less coincident with each other. Now, we haven't been able to track down that difference of a factor of 2. It could just be an experimental error or a misunderstanding about some of the published data for one of the many factors that have gone into calculating the coefficients, or it could be something more fundamental. Plot shows data with many different styles of points. As I said earlier, the crosses are for the upper layer. In the lower layer, experiments were done with different depths of the material, and there is a very, very weak dependence, but some dependence on the depth of the material. As you make the lower layer thinner, not surprisingly, the period goes down a little bit. Also, the color coding is a color coding for the size of the xi parameter, and that varies over more than a decade. There's no consistent way in which the different symbols or colors are moving away from the trend, apart from the fact that in the lower layer there's a slight tendency for the squares and the circles to be lower than the dots, indicating some dependence on the height of the system. But this is really a strong indication that all of the scalings are correct, and therefore a strong indication that, in fact, Ostwald ripening is a real part of the story here.
I have again a question.
Yep.
As you have recalled, the Lifshitz-Slezov mechanism is associated to a particular distribution of the sizes, which is quite untypical because it has a negative skewness.
Yeah.
Contrary to the usual distribution that we have in nature, which have positive skewness, contrary. So have they been able to measure this or to?
Not really. I showed the
value, because here, from what I can read, the skewness is again positive. I mean, the probability to have small sizes is larger than the one to have larger sizes.
So you mean skewness is just what
would predict the contrary? If it goes off, there is a peak at large excursion and then a long tail towards the small sizes.
This is a left tail of Peter.
The left
tail. Presumes that there is
exactly. And then there is a sharp cutoff after the maximum.
If I could comment here, the data that we have is really this. Now, the regions where the Lifshitz-Slezov theory is supposed to be relevant are those where there is very little turbidity, there are very few particles present. And the crossover point where you go from Lifshitz-Slezov growth to gravitational settling causing a runaway is actually at sizes that I think are below the resolution of the optics. So really, in the data that we have, we don't have any discriminating test on that. If you ask about whether whether there would be modifications of the Lifshitz-Klyazov theory because, for example, we're adding supersaturation at a constant rate rather than just having a sort of annealed degree of supersaturation. I don't think that makes any difference. I think in principle it's the same, exactly the same distribution appears in the theory, but it seems to be beyond our experiment to see it.
But it's, I think it's still an issue, so if you could produce to see the Lifshitz-Klyazov, people have tried to find it and they've never found it. There are always all other mechanisms which screen.
I think that would those other mechanisms would in fact abound in this case. The distribution produced by their theory, it's skewed, but it's nevertheless a rather narrow distribution, and it would be very hard to get a discriminating test of it. Anyway, something that I think is interesting as a general lesson is to consider this issue in respect of real clouds. Now, I mentioned this issue of a supposed condensation collision bottleneck in the growth of water droplets in real clouds. However, this Ostwald ripening mechanism seems to be a way of avoiding such difficulties, because you can transfer water vapor from one droplet to another without actually having to bring the droplets into collision. It also has a nice feature that the predicted growth law actually doesn't really require that much input data, and very significantly it's independent of the density of water droplets, which is a very variable, intermittent and uncertain parameter of cloud physics. The numbers here are really numbers that you can just pull out of a chemistry data booklet. The diffusion, surface tension, this is diffusion of water vapor in air, surface tension of water, molar volume, and saturation vapor pressure at saturation vapor fraction at 10 degrees centigrade, just numbers you can pull out of textbooks. You can calculate the capillary length, and using the diffusion constant, you can make an estimate for the growth of water droplets. I missed an M for meters there. But you can see from this expression that to reach 60 microns, which would be 60 times 10 to the minus 6 meters, you'd have to get this factor up to T over S would have to be 1,000. That's about 15 or 20 minutes. So reaching sizes of 50 microns by Ostwald ripening just takes a quarter of an hour or so. There isn't really any barrier to any bottleneck in the growth of water droplets, and no turbulence is required. This mechanism works whether the air is turbulent or not.
Doesn't it depend on what is the initial distribution of droplets over sizes?
No, it just assumes that there's something there to cause the initial nucleation event. But once that happens, there's nothing else to choose, and that's your law. It can only break down if the nuclei are so far apart that it takes a very long time for water molecules to diffuse from one droplet to another. Now, if you make some crude estimates, well, the droplet densities are about 10 to the 8 per cubic meter. They're about a millimeter apart. It takes a water molecule about a second or less to diffuse that distance. So so this does seem to be an appropriate growth law for conditions inside clouds. So I'll just go to the conclusion. So I've made for the first time, I think, a quantitative description of a precipitation cycle. It gives a rather surprising scaling of period as a function of cooling rates, but this rather odd scaling exponent is well borne out by the experimental data. We guess a pretty good fit to the prefactor as well, just assuming this dimension, this alpha, is equal to 1, despite the fact that the density contrast and the interfacial tension are both singular at the phase transition. So I think this formula has been quite convincingly established. So the new element, or what I believe to be a new element, is the idea that Ostwald ripening can be important. I've argued that in the context of real clouds, this Ostwald ripening process gives a baseline growth rate which is also present, which is always present, regardless of the existence of turbulence. And using the standard textbook data, it seems there is no significant growth bottleneck. A way of putting the bottleneck back does actually occur to me, however. The discussion I've given so far assumes that the nucleation centers are kind of passive. One possibility is that if you nucleate on hygroscopic grains, perhaps some salt thrown up by sea spray, then as the water droplet grows, the salt gets diluted, and that can help to stabilize the distribution of particle sizes. So there might be some, suggested by this Ostwald-Ripening mechanism, there might be some other interesting issues about bottlenecks in droplet growth, but they're rather different to the ones that have been looked at by people in the turbulence community. Anyway, I'll thank you for your attention and stop there.
Let me give you two remarks. Number one, there's a big experiment in Karlsruhe where they have an adiabatic chamber, which is about 5 meters big, where they let it even snow. So where they can do adiabatic decompression, which would be exactly your condition. You just keep let the air out and leave it coming out, which means it would cool down constantly. And so this would be an experiment where one could look whether it happens with water vapor, and you would try it.
Possibly, but that really would be a rapid process, and Ostwald ripening assumes that there's a certain degree of slowness in the process.
So how do you get in the cloud, actually? How do you get in the cloud, this constant change in temperature?
Now, clouds would be slow in the stratus, but then by your theory, by your theory, any stratus cloud would disappear in half an hour because Ostwald ripening.
Yes, precisely, and this is a possible.
Bother you? just look around. They are all over us.
My second comment. Turbulent mixing in these clouds is very dominant. Cumulus clouds.
Yeah, but let's say that stratus is precisely the ideal place where the theory is supposed to work.
Right, yeah.
So what the theory predicts is that such clouds do not exist because
why does it run away?
They
reappear after that. They reappear, so they exist transitorily.
What do you mean reappear? They will just all moisture will come out.
He has a constant concentration of nuclei, so that the cloud reappears at the same time.
If that would look for you like a real world, like the stratus reappearing every 20 minutes.
Stratus cloud is normally associated with a warm front where a layer of warm air is sliding over some cooler air, and you get a layer of cloud produced at the interface. Well, it's possible that, for example, there can be a settling of droplets out of this layer into the warmer area below where they continually just evaporate away. So apart from the mechanism that I suggested at the end, I could think of many other mechanisms for explaining the persistence of observation of stratus cloud.
On the other hand, what is known in what people, and it's very similar to what you say, is a mechanism which is related to ice crystals on top of the stratus clouds. It's exactly the same mechanism that's not related to surface tension and related to the temperature, because if you have a large ice particle, it cools air more than small ice particle. As a result, it's here is less saturated, here is more saturated, no? Other way around. So small ice particle evaporate was a vapor which goes towards large particle, and it's a very relatively fast process, and it is what actually describes the rain from cold clouds, the tops which are frozen. So it is this mechanism just not driven by surface tension but driven by temperature. Mm-hmm. But as far as this surface tension driven, it would be that simple, the stratus would not exist.
Well, I can give you multiple ideas.
Chemistry is some kind of way out. And we do know that at least, you know, here in California, all the clouds are salty, that's for sure. I mean, they all are.
Never right.
On spring. Come on.
Never right.
Yeah. We all enjoyed this weekend. Okay, anyway, more questions?
I'm actually very happy that you brought this, because it almost surprised me that cloud physics always ignored what we all knew in coarsening dynamics. I mean, this is standard coarsening stuff.
Yeah.
You quench into the region where you have two-phase coexistence, you get this. So I think even if this is not true, it should be ruled out in great detail before we do something more sophisticated than this.
Yeah.
Having said that, in the old days, there was something which was supposed to set in after Lifshitz-Klosov, and that was the mechanism due to Sygia, where eventually the length increased linearly in time.
No, the volume. Well, this is the same rule.
Is it the same thing?
Yeah, exactly. That was an alternative interpretation of the same result.
I see. Okay, probably.
Volume increases.
So probably I missed a factor. Okay. So that is there, and as far as I know, these regimes have been seen at least at the level of Lattice-Boltzmann simulations from the group of Michael Cates.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say that, you know, people should look at this seriously for clouds.
Well, the clouds usually fast. Normally, when there is a condensation which goes into clouds, this goes much, much faster than anything, this adiabatic type of process. But in some kind of, you know, long existing stratus, that really could be something like slow process of getting into it, and then it would suggest that they would be very fast separate. Okay? Yeah.
Yeah, an observation. Speaking about negative skewness, in turbulence, the velocity derivative and negative skewness, I don't know if there are possible correlations.
I really wouldn't know. I think my main thesis has been that cloud physics should be moving away from turbulence. So
yeah. I think it's
you have to restrict yourself to fog that's sitting in the stratocumulus, which is not moving. Send a Barbara Mary layers, perhaps.
As long as there's a cumulus, there's so much turbulence that they cannot really move.
We cannot move away from it. It's possible.
Just try flying ball into it.
Or to rephrase that actually more carefully, I think cloud microphysics should move away from turbulence. The macrophysics is definitely very strongly influenced. Yeah.
Okay, yeah.